Hello, everybody, and welcome to another LPAssociation.com podcast. As always, I am your host, Derek, and today I am joined by my fellow staff members, Todd and Lewis. Go ahead, guys.
Hey, what's up? This is Todd.
Hi.
Also, we do have some very special guests in our podcast this afternoon. We have the guys from Ghost Town. Without further ado, if you guys would like to introduce yourselves and tell everyone about what you do, go ahead, please.
I'm Matt. I am the producer, post-producer guy for Ghost Town.
I'm Brandon. I do a lot of our graphic design, visual effectsing. I do a lot of the aesthetic builds and kind of utility play over here.
And I'm David. I'm mostly the technical guy, doing a lot of the workflow stuff and some of the effects as well, like tracking and compositing.
That's it. That's Ghost Town.
That is all.
All right, that's our podcast.
That's our podcast. We're done. Just kidding. All right. So what we did in order to make this podcast move a little bit smoother than usual, we actually got a couple questions gathered in advance. So we're going to start off with a generic one. Basically, where, when, and how did you guys start doing this stuff? How did you get your start?
Oh, boy. Well, let's see here. The company originally formed some years back. Where basically what we were was kind of the way that it works out here in the industry is a lot of people kind of work as freelancers, and essentially there's kind of a small collection of us that would work together, but then at times they actually work against each other, kind of outbidding each other to try to get different work. We eventually decided to kind of form up a little bit and try to join forces, and basically from there that was the start of Ghost Town. And since then we've gone through a couple different iterations of the company. At one point bloating to include editorial and production and all kinds of different stuff under the sun. But these days we've kind of thinned our focus down a little bit more, and essentially are now just kind of focusing on kind of the design aesthetics and a lot of the stuff that you guys have been seeing with our work with LP.
And as far as our background, aside from Jeff, one of our partners who's actually overseas right now, everybody was kind of trained in other things. Dave is self-taught and has been doing this for years and years and years. Brandon was a fine arts major at USC. I had nothing to do with the entertainment industry. I actually was a history major and then real estate development associate for 4 years before I started doing this. So our background is varied and wide and kind of random. But, you know, over the last 3 years or so since Ghost Town has been an official company, we've just been kind of learning as we go and, you know, picking up skills here and there.
All right. Very cool. How did you guys get involved with Linkin Park?
That was as it usually goes, kind of a chance occurrence. We had done a video a couple years back for Kanye, Welcome to Heartbreak, where we had messed around with this technique called data moshing, and it had caught Joe's eye. And we actually got a random call in the midst of kind of a nightmarish project from where Joe's trying to reach out to us. But we actually didn't know it was Joe trying to get a hold of us, so we actually almost didn't call him back. We were kind of having a rough week, and then it wasn't a whole lot of information on the message, and we're like, we really ought to probably just fire him a call back. And next thing I know, Joe's here at the office, and we're kind of chatting through stuff, and that led us to the first project, which was New Divide, that we worked with them.
And that one falls more on me, because I would have been the one responsible for having not called. Bill Boyd, I'm sure you see his name on a bunch of stuff, is Joe's producer. They work together, their creative team. And Bill had called him because it was the Transformers tie-in. He basically left a message saying, "Hi, my name's Bill. I've got a project I'd like to talk to you about. Please call me back." Like Brandon said, we were in the middle of 22-hour days for a client that was unreasonable, and you know, we were not sleeping and all this stuff. And we got to a point where, actually having talked to Bill about this recently, he said, "I was about 24 hours from just calling another post company. I had to get an answer." And luckily, you know, we called Bill back, and like Brandon said, Joe and Bill came and sat down, and we sat for an afternoon and went through some ideas, and that turned into New Divide, which was our kind of first creative foray with Joe and the band and their team.
Well, actually, branching off of that, since you did mention that you guys almost didn't call him back, Someone asked a really interesting question. Have you guys ever had to turn down working on a project? And if so, why?
That happens actually quite often. There's a myriad of reasons.
What's my motto? Play to win. What's the key? Logistics.
What?
It takes planning. Everybody.
What is that?
When you hit play on JTV, apparently they have a UPS ad before you actually see it. Wanted to test something, but I forgot about that.
So, as you were saying, go ahead.
Where was I? There's a myriad of reasons why you turn down work. Yes, we turn down work all the time. A lot of times people have no concept of how much time and effort things take, and so in turn, really don't really attach a whole heck of a lot of budget to stuff. They're like, I have this feature that I want to do just some 3D effects, you know, some fighting robots. Oh, okay, cool. Well, how much do you have? Well, I got a lot of money here. I got like $1,500, and you're like, do you have any idea how much 3D costs? So you run into that sometimes, and you always sound like a jerk whenever you're like, you don't have enough money for me, but like literally, there's kind of that facet to it. There's also kind of a creative aspect to it for us too. There was a day when we first started where we were literally doing 30 projects a month, and it was, it was a nose first grind. And what you find is when you do that much work, you don't really have enough to kind of focus your proper efforts towards each one. So you can get run a little thin and not deliver projects you're necessarily totally thrilled with. We've kind of taken the notion at this point that we'd rather do one thing really well at a time than doing 30 things pretty well. So,
And to that point, honestly, you know, the money side of it is there. You know, we have to be real. We are running a business, but we're a small house. I mean, the three people that are on this call and then maybe two or three other people are around, you know, pretty often. Aside from that, we definitely are. We kind of grow and contract based off projects. So, you know, it doesn't take seven figures to garner our time, but there is kind of a threshold of work to resources that we have to adhere to. Otherwise we'd go out of business. So, you know, creatively, that's the first thing we look at on any project. And if we think it's creatively viable, something we'd be interested in doing, we take a hard look at it. And then it's a matter of, will this at least allow us at a minimum to keep our doors open?
Okay. Just looking through like the series of questions we have here, trying to find ones that are really interesting. A good question, and again, this ties into what you said earlier. Someone said in the chat, how long does it typically take from beginning to end to work on a project, like from pre-production to the final product? You know, how long does it take to get that completely finished?
Honestly, the pre-pro is kind of the biggest mountain you climb each time, because there's so many really cool things that everyone wants to do, and then there's the reality of how many days do we have to shoot this, and how long do they, and how long do we have in post to kind of do it. I'd say on average, a project kind of gets kind of birthed and really put together and wrapped out, I'd say inside of like a month and a half, 2 months each time. We usually like to have at least three weeks for our post-production side, not necessarily including edit. And then we usually shoot for a day or 2 days. Bill and the production team, you know, he usually needs about a week and a half or two to really get everything kind of pulled together. And before that, we'll talk sometime. I mean, you know, for shit's sake, I think we've talked sometimes for upwards of 4 months about an idea before we actually kind of get the tires on the road.
Yeah, and you know, for the typical music video, that's the easiest one to kind of give a real answer to. From the date that the label basically says this is greenlit, we like the concept, the budget is approved, a week to 2 weeks for pre-production, you shoot for a day or two, maybe three. A week and a half to 2 weeks for edit, and then 3 weeks to 4 weeks for post. So that puts us at, you know, on the short end, 4 to 5 weeks, 8 weeks on the larger end. But you look at something like the Meeting of a Thousand Suns documentary, that was 120 days of prep time and editing and all that stuff. You know, but that's a 30-minute documentary. So, you know, depending on what the project is, it can fluctuate pretty wildly. But, you know, a month to 2 months is pretty safe.
Speaking of A Meeting of Thousand Suns, you guys said in when you were working through that DVD that I believe Mark Fiore, their videographer, gave you guys, I think it was over 100 hours of footage. Has Linkin Park ever specified that they might plan to release, you know, more of that footage down the road in a different DVD? I mean, have you ever heard any plans of that, or is that something that you think they might just keep for, like, LPTV?
As far as their plans, I don't know. As far as what we would like to see, for Ghost Town, creatively, we feel like that documentary was the first part of something more. You know, the idea of what is it like to make an album, what is it like to release the album, come up with singles. But then they went on a world tour, they promoted it, they were all over the place. So, you know, from our perspective, we'd love to see it as a continuation. But as far as what the band's doing, that's kind of unknown until they call and say, hey, guys, do another 30-minute documentary or whatever that might be.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of one of those things where when you're around, you hear lots of things in opposite directions. So has that been brought up before? Probably. But there's probably been just as many voices saying in the opposite direction of, I think we do what we need to do there. So, you know, it's kind of a matter of, you know, which way the ball bounces on the right day to kind of get everything to sync up for that to kind of thing push forward, you know.
And I think to your question, you know, of that 100-and-some hours of footage, the idea of how might it be used, you know, when we come through it, a lot of Mark is shooting, I mean, it's recording sessions, it's studio time, it's, you know, kind of Mike and Chester, you know, at Mike's home studio. It's a lot of stuff that, you know, Mark was getting just coverage of. And I feel like the documentary is a pretty accurate indication of what that footage looked like. Obviously, there's a lot more kind of funny anecdotes and little funny moments between the guys that just is a natural kind of progression of their time together. But it's not like we were hiding away, you know, when they go play paintball and jump off a bridge together.
Yeah.
You know, that stuff wasn't necessarily hiding in there.
Very cool. So you guys mentioned on your website that you did some work on the upcoming 1,000 Suns plus DVD package thing. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
I mean, essentially what we did is we did the opening credits and the menu design and kind of general aesthetics as usual for the DVD packaging. It's basically an encapsulation of their Madrid show from the EMAs, which was I was actually fortunate enough to actually be there for that show. And it was a pretty incredible event to be there firsthand. I mean, must have been 60,000 people there, just, you know, for about a mile, you know, a mile deep of people just freaking out. It was actually really, really incredible. They were an incredible crowd too. There was people there at like 8:30 in the morning, just freaking out. Even the sound check in the morning turned into just total bedlam. I mean, it was as much energy as I've seen in a lot of the concerts. So I think for that, it was just them kind of trying to encapsulate. A little bit of that energy and kind of share that out with the audience.
By the way, if you get that DVD, if you look really hard on the right side of the stage, you'll see Brandon standing there just watching from the wing. So if you guys figure out who it is, you can get a little bit of an Easter egg of Brandon hanging out on the side, enjoying the show.
I have showed my face a couple times. I've managed to show up a couple times in the LPTV stuff and the behind the scenes. So I that's a little Easter egg. If you're super bored, you can try to find my ugly mug in there.
Maybe we could do like a giveaway where we do a giveaway and whoever finds Brandon first gets a prize.
And we just, by the way, saw a comment in the chat about how Brandon sounds like Brad. Well, Dave, who's here, that has a little bit of a Brad tie-in that he would like to talk about.
I don't know if I'd like to talk about it, but are we even allowed to talk about it is the bigger question.
Well, I mean, essentially with Burning the Skies, Dave had to, Brad wasn't feeling that great, and so Dave had to kind of serve a stand-in a couple times. For the when we're trying to kind of get some of our blockings and stuff in there, And it was actually kind of eerie, the resemblance between betwixt the two of them. They're fairly similar fellows when you take a quick snap of it.
Yeah, you want to talk about major Easter egg? That would probably be the top one right there.
Oh, so for all this time, you think it's Brad in the video, and it might be you?
For at least one of the videos, yes.
that's fun.
When I'm doing post-production, I like to put myself all into my work, apparently, and go all out.
Yeah, we've actually kind of made a bit of a habit of that. Most of the Ghost Town crew is actually in The Catalyst. We actually did a bunch of shooting for that. I'm actually here. We put up a little mini psych. When you see all the people in the gas masks, that's actually us. We knew what we wanted to see in there, and it's much easier just to do it than try to communicate it.
Yeah, and for the concert graphics, too. I mean, you know, a lot of the face-wrapped kind of people and the gas mask people are, you know, Brandon or Dave or Gabriel, who worked with us on the project, or Jeff or even me every once in a while. The people running around kind of in the military gear, that's us.
The wide crowd shots, those are just... Those are just filthy extras.
Someone said it's like the Paul is dead conspiracy from the Beatles, that Brad doesn't exist and it's really been you in the videos all along.
We can neither confirm nor deny that.
Oh, man. It was a really good question that I was just looking into. Speaking about The Catalyst, the whole plot of that video has been wildly open to interpretation. Some people think it's basically...
Wait, there?
Uh-oh. Derek, looks like Derek got kicked out by accident. I guess I'll finish up his question for him in the meantime. But I think what Derek was trying to ask...
All right.
What the hell happens?
I don't...
God damn it. We try our hardest to make that sure that these podcasts go as smoothly as possible and that there's no technical issues, but it always happens all the freaking time. And no, I did not have to fart, so I muted myself. That did not happen. So, okay. So I think I was going to ask you guys about The Catalyst. Okay. A lot of people think of Burning in the Skies and The Catalyst as kind of companion pieces. A lot of people think of Burning in the Skies as what happens before the bomb drops and right when the bomb drops. But then in The Catalyst, it's kind of been open to interpretation. There's some people who don't quite understand what's going on during the video. And there's this one part in the video, you actually reminded me of it when you told us that you guys were actually the people in the gas mask. There's this one part where like Mike's like charging towards one of the gas mask people. I mean, is Mike fighting the person? I mean, is Linkin Park supposed to be the people who are saving the world in that video? I mean, do you know anything about the plot and what it was supposed to be? Because it's kind of been a little bit confusing to some people. So,
I mean, the thing is, we've kind of talked on a little some of this stuff before when we had to play this role of trying to play interpretation. Joe and the guys like to kind of have stuff exist in kind of an abstract space. They like things that aren't necessarily a clean answer. To validate that a little bit, because I know it's a kind of a craptastic answer I'm giving here, but but you talk to anyone that's been to art school, and of course for those guys they have, you know, it's, you know, where a lot of them, you know, kind of got their start is in their fine art kind of backgrounds. Having a piece that has one specific answer to it is kind of seen as a failure when you deal with a lot of high art. You want things that kind of create conversations that you want to talk about. So inside of that, now I can actually kind of give you some more specific answers. I think the thing that the guys really wanted to kind of hit for, and I think overarchingly with the Thousand Suns album, is it's kind of a meditation and an exploration of kind of the human element to a certain degree. Like we as almost like a sociological, you know, stare at kind of the people we are. Like you look at Burning in the Skies, and it's really about kind of the, you know, these people, everyone kind of encapsulated in their own mundane melodrama to a certain degree, and how so much of this all just gets neutralized when there's kind of, you know, when something major happens, you know? I mean, we even look to, you know, I mean, sadly what just happened in Japan, and the bottom line is you have millions of people here who are all kind of inundated with their own crap every day, and yet you have, you know, any of these overarching items kind of happen, and all of a sudden it catalyzes and it unifies people. And so then when you look at the catalyst, you're seeing kind of this infighting and kind of just this general sense of despair and kind of loss that the world is kind of sitting in. And even inside of that, it's not, you know, people only get along even for so long inside of that. And so we're seeing even inside of the video how there's kind of chaos reigning inside of there. People can't even necessarily get their act together tightly enough to figure their way out of it. They're even doing infighting inside of that. So I think, there is kind of a sociological, I think, kind of expression that's happening inside of all these pieces where we're kind of studying kind of the human condition. Sorry, did I get way too deep there? Like, and the audience is glazed over.
Yeah, we're just trying to comprehend what you said, man.
I mean, the short answer is there is no definite narrative to it. Like, there is no, you know, Mike is an angel, he is death. You know, that answer is not there. It's just a matter of, you know, there are a couple different overarching themes that each video is touched into, that the concert touches into very briefly. And, you know, like Brandon said, they're kind of more abstract ideas that, you know, we're trying to touch on without necessarily saying, in this video, the apocalypse happens and then there's a fight and this, that, and the other. Just because, you know, the nature of the album is kind of a concept in itself, and we wanted the visuals to kind of go in that same direction.
Yeah.
And Joe obviously had those thoughts as well with his treatments, and kind of keeping it nebulous on purpose to allow each person to kind of take, frankly, what they saw in it out of it in a way that made them feel happy or challenged them or made them unhappy or whatever it is.
I mean, there is a lot of intention in it, though. It's not like it's not like an 80s minimalist painting where there's a red dot in the middle of it and you can make whatever you want it to be. There's obviously a mental space that this is all kind of existing in. And so when you think about kind of the general notion of catastrophe or of, yeah, you know, everyone's constantly convinced that we're all sitting on our own proverbial end of days. This album for them has kind of been a nice exploration of kind of what that moment would be and what would we see out of ourselves inside of there. And I think that each one of the songs gives different opportunities to explore different aspects of this human element. You look at like Wretches and Kings, and that's, you know, I mean, and that's a song just about pure revolt and how it's a cyclical item. You know, you have all these, you know, you have these really raw emotions that show up, and then you have kind of these more moments of kind of contemplation inside of there. And I think each one of the songs, as we kind of flush these through to visual elements, gives kind of really nice opportunity to kind of ask questions to ourselves of, you know, it kind of gives us the ability to kind of postulate a little bit of how would this go down.
And I think looking at Burning in the Skies and The Catalyst and Waiting for the End, they represent various kind of places on the scale for that abstractness. You know, Burning in the Skies seems to be a little bit more direct, whereas Waiting for the End is kind of literally out in space. It's, you know, in a black void. So there's kind of a wide gamut of how close to home the narrative is and how direct it is and how kind of up for consideration it is.
Wow, that's actually really cool that you guys you have sort of this analysis of it, working with Linkin Park. That's really great. The question I wanted to ask was that, and I guess just to tie it in with everything else, do you guys like really? Would you say that you guys really enjoy working with the band? And do you guys have any other projects that you plan on having with Linkin Park, or do you guys not yet, or do you guys want to like work with them still? What's the plan for that?
You know, to put it very succinctly. Working with Linkin Park on a both creative and professional level has been the most validating and pleasurable and rewarding experience we've had thus far. As far as, you know, normal client relationships go, we consider Bill and Joe and the management team, you know, friends with us, and we are a creative team with them. Obviously, you know, we're not concepting everything, and ultimately, at the end of the day, the approval goes to them. But the guys are exceptionally nice. They're open to ideas. They really respect creative input. And from our perspective, I can't think of another group of people that we would rather spend creative time with. And frankly, that would, you know, validate the time and effort we put in to creating what we do for them.
It's very easy to forget the kind of work that we do. We're not directors of these projects. We're not DPs. We don't have one of the sexy roles, frankly. We're, you know, I mean, you know, we're the guys that spend 2 months, you know, grinding our faces off, up all night, you know, just cracked out on Red Bull trying to get stuff done on deadlines. Make a lot of creative decisions, and we do a lot of hard work, and it's oftentimes has been forgotten. And these guys, you know, the LP family that we kind of call it, has been incredible. You know, in not only how appreciative they've been at the hard work that's been done, but the ability to kind of let us in a little bit on the creative process. When we started working with them, specifically for the Thousand Suns album and all of the ensuing videos and media that we've been attached to, it's been a massive collaboration. And when we went to them, they asked us, like, you know, point blank, what do you see? Like, you know, we went in for a couple listening sessions. And, you know, I mean, basically under lock and key with, you know, the barrel, you know, snugly put next to the back of my head in case I was recording. But we went in there and we listened and we were able to contemplate, and we came back to them with a full kind of spread of, this is where we see this, and this is where we see you inside of it, you know. And they'd given us reference and people and things that they were into, and it's been great, you know, because essentially, you know, Joe has been so good with us, you know, because, like, you know, he'll come and he'll sit and chat, and he'll have a basic kind of kernel of an idea, and we kind of work through it, and he has a vision that he wants this thing to fall under, and he lets us kind of really put ourselves in there to make it as cool as we possibly can make it. Because, you know, one thing that he realizes is that if people are excited and are motivated about the project and believe in what they're making, they'll make better work.
I mean, with my experiences with working with the guys too, I mean, I had never worked like directly per se. I mean, that's something that you guys have the honor of doing, but just from communicating with the band on various occasions, I can echo the sentiment that they're very down to earth guys and that they know what they're doing. They are very, very, you know, creative visually. And I would imagine, you know, working on them on their videos, I would imagine it's probably a really rewarding experience. Someone asked in the chat, they said that they read somewhere, not sure if it was for your official site or on the internet, that you created about 3 hours worth of footage for the 1,000 Suns live tour. Because of the average Linkin Park show is about an hour and a half, what's happening to the rest of the footage? I mean, is that going to be used later on, or?
Well, it's a mix.
Yeah, it's... To answer that one quickly, and I'll let Brandon get into the details of it, you know, we created a wide swath of each type of look. For example, if you've seen the show, The Pyramid, we had 25 minutes of pyramid stuff that we then chose selects, and we pulled some good parts out, and we still have a lot of the other stuff, but, you know, cutting room floor, a lot of it ends up there that doesn't necessarily have a home. But because of the breadth and depth of the work we do with the band, we try to find places to sneak some of these assets in. If they're not necessarily what we created directly for the tour, we use assets or raw pieces
or techniques
and kind of put them back in somewhere else.
I mean, because the bottom line is like, when, you know, when you look at, you know, for those who've had a chance to see the live tour, you know, when you look at like Numb, or when you look at Faint, is actually a great example. Faint has a very specific style to it, and there's probably 15 different actual elements that never even made it into there, just because it just didn't work. You know, it didn't have the right synesthetic reaction, or just didn't seem to fit the mood or timing. It's kind of one of those things where you know, if you sit down and bake 400 brownies, not every single one of them may taste as good as the other one is. So there's a lot of stuff that probably will never see the light of day that we just didn't think was up to snuff. of you know, because it, you know, when you're doing this kind of stuff, it's like sketching. You know, I use this a lot. brownies. it's like sketching, and not all your sketches look good, and not all your sketches have a home. But you keep sketching, and you keep kind of active, and you keep moving, and you keep trying, and that's how you make these breakthroughs. You know, but if you know, some stuff won't see the light of day. Some stuff has kind of gotten really you know, but some stuff has gotten really kind of flushed out. I mean, frankly, the Waiting for the End video was based upon trials that we ran during the initial tests for Faint. The initial gas mask that you saw in the opening seconds of that video clip was a quick test that was done downstairs, and it was cool enough. They were like, "There's something to this." And we kept working and brought Joe in on it, and all of a sudden we have a music video on our hands.
Just trying to look for other questions here. here's a good one. This goes kind of back towards way, way in the beginning of the podcast. How close of a relationship do you guys, you know, normally build with your clients? Is it normally a case of working from a brief, or do you and your clients basically collaborate as much as possible at post-production stage as well?
You know, to be honest, the way that we work best, because, you know, I think we'd be classified as a boutique post house, we're not Digital Domain, we're not ILM, we're not Weta, you know, we're not doing $100 million VFX jobs. So we strive to work extremely closely and collaboratively with our clients. I think the best work that we've done, and if any, you know, anybody who's familiar with our work, the stuff like Kanye Welcome to Heartbreak or MGMT Electric Feel or Block Party Signs, the stuff that kind of allowed us to shine was done in a truly collaborative relationship with our clients. And we'd rather have a client feel like they can put together a treatment that, hey, this is the idea that I want, this is what I'm looking to do, and then basically turn it over to us and say, do you guys have any notes, thoughts? Do you have any kind of creative direction? And allow a conversation to happen so that, you know, their idea of what they want and what we think we can deliver are fully integrated. Not necessarily somebody goes and shoots a music video, hands us a treatment and goes, hey, I've got 3 hours of footage or I've got 2 hours of footage. Do this effect for me. We can do that. Obviously, you know, we can rotoscope and composite and we can key and do all that other stuff.
But it's not nearly as fun as being involved.
And it frankly leads to a worse product, in our opinion. The more that we're allowed to kind of play in the sandbox, and you might hear us say that a couple times, like literally, if we get to build sandcastles for a little while and be like, no, I hate that one, let's try this other one, it'll end up with something that looks vastly better and looks a lot bigger than it was.
Cool. Shen wanted to know in our chat, props to Shen, he actually came out and asked a question in regards to what type of equipment do you guys use? There's a lot of aspiring video editors out there in the Linkin Park fan base, people who want to go ahead and do what you guys are doing. And a lot of people want to know, you know, what type of equipment do you guys use? You know, what type of software do you guys utilize to make your videos? What type of equipment do you use? Any specific recommendations for computers, video editing equipment and the like? What do you guys use?
Yeah, we feel pretty strongly on the way we do things here. We're an Apple house, first and foremost. Having a computer that's, you know, we all started as PC boys and basically became converts later in life. And so we're all Apple Mac pros here. Pretty built-out systems. You know, some of the systems are as high as, you know, 20, 30 gigs of RAM. You know, they're all minimum 8 cores. You know, a lot of times your base video cards, so nothing too crazy there. So it's things that, you know, that plenty of us humans can afford, you know, saving for a little while. And then in terms of software, we are really big on cocktails of stuff. For 3D, we use C4D. It's the fastest, most effective method for getting 3D done. We've worked with Maya, but it's a pain in the ass. It just takes forever. You can make some great stuff, but it takes forever. C4D is great; it's really efficient. We also use Synthize. That's been our tracking solution for all of the 3D solves and camera tracking that we do. We've been using that for years and have always been big proponents of that. And then in terms of where we do most of our work, that's in After Effects, frankly. Most people scoff at us when they hear, "Oh, After Effects, that's like a toy." It's sure. If you want to treat it like that, sure, it's a toy. So is Final Cut. Final Cut can be seen as a toy too, which we also use. But but our version of After Effects is kind of a built-out freak. David here is really heavy into scripting and coding, and basically, the flexibility that we have with After Effects is A, it's almost like Photoshop in the fact that you can kind of design as on the fly versus a nodal-based compositor. And I know I'm going to go over some heads on this one, but node-based compositing that you'd see in Nuke or any of those guys can be a little... that's fine when you have a really cool CG robot that you rendered out of 3D and you comp it perfectly into this well-shot scene. That's fine. That's post that makes sense. We do post in a non-traditional format here. It's actually part of the reason why we have a hard time finding people to work with us inside, because the way we work here is a little flipped than how most people do. We like lots of layers, we like to pull in lots of analog effects, and one of the big things that Dave does too is he allows us to basically remove repetitive steps by doing scripting. And you can actually go to aescripts.com, and he's part of the group over there that he actually has a lot of scripts for sale that he builds, and a lot of these scripts that he sells there are based on the projects that we do inside here. So if you need to trim timelines, do different things that would take you, if you have in your average music video, you have 172 different shots inside of there. If I got to do something to every single one of those shots, I mean, I got to do that 172 times. I could lose half my day just, just putting a color adjustment on. That's where Dave comes in. He basically is like, okay, what's your repetitive task? Let me get rid of that for you. And basically he makes it so the machine can do that for us, so we have more time to do the fun, cool stuff to make stuff look better.
Yeah, a lot of the crazy, if you're ever lucky enough to see our interface via a screen cap or something, it just looks insane. We have so many windows and panels that are docked in there. Literally, we're all working on dual monitors right now just so we can have the visual on one monitor and literally all of our tools and palettes on the other monitor. It takes up so much room. And it's just something that if I can streamline that process, then we can focus on the more important issues that we have to deal with. You know, a lot of the creative issues and hurdles that we come across trying to design things. And a lot of that I do share, like Brandon was saying, that website, I saw somebody asking about that. It's aescripts.com, and they have a lot of stuff along those lines, automation tools.
It's actually a pretty incredible setup. Basically, the reason why After Effects is kind of cool these days is because what it's done is there's an open source kit that essentially is allowing people to make their own forms of plugins. And it's getting really complex and really powerful, and it's pushing the strength and size of the application. It's been pretty fun actually recently with some of the recent advents. I did see a question there. I'm going to help someone out here. We're not against the use of Linux or Windows at all. Everything has its right place and time. The thing is that for people like us, we have we oftentimes will have 7 different applications running at the exact same time. I have 3D renders going in the background while I'm tracking footage that just came in, while I'm compositing and doing color builds for the upcoming project, and Linux just doesn't have the availability. It doesn't have all the applications that I need to run on it. Obviously, it's a really great workflow, and I love the idea of an open source system. The Darth Vader-ness of Apple can be a little daunting at times, and I don't always agree with everything that happens with that. But at the same time, Windows has only recently started, as far as I'm concerned, getting more stable, and I do need to go on the internet, and I do need to check my email and things like that. And I just, my experiences with Windows was just so poor. I can't tell you how many projects I lost just outright due to just bad programming on that part. So,
and to kind of
way against me.
Yeah, and I'm not remotely a technical person. You know, I've been a PC person my whole life, but I don't do the work. You know, I'm the guy that basically is fielding the angry phone calls from other people about things being late or over budget or whatever it is. That being said, you know, having worked with some other post houses, because a lot of times we don't do everything in-house, we'll outsource some things. There are a lot of people that live and die by PC, and they think that, you know, Maya, for example, or Cinema 4D will run better on PC, and you can do more with the actual kind of hardware that you're working with in your system. Again, it's personal preference. I know a lot of houses that we work with and compete against use PCs and other formats, you know, Linux-based systems, but we just happen to prefer Mac. We kind of, I think we're all getting old enough now that it's one of those things, it's like teaching an old dog new tricks. We understand the quirks of it. So it's easier to debug. And to kind of finish that thought, these projects generally are so, we put so much stress on ourselves, and the projects generally put so much stress kind of on making a good product, that if you woke up one morning and walked into your office and had a technical problem that wasn't software-based but was hardware-based, we probably would kill ourselves. dealing with that kind of unknown on top of the unknown of, is this effect going to work? Is this cocktail of plugins going to give me the look I want? That's a bit too much risk for us personally, which is why we stick to a more stable format.
Very cool. The next question I want to ask is from the chat. We wanted to ask if you guys know if there will be a making of the Burning in the Skies video released at some point in the future.
I have heard rumblings of such things.
We've handed off some of our making of and some of the before and after footage that I believe is for the purpose of a making of Burning in the Skies. So if I were to guess, I'd say at some point, yeah, there probably would be.
That's not my department. Let me connect you, honey.
And I just want to jump in and voice my support for After Effects. A lot of people try to act like you said, like it's a toy, but a few people really realize just how often After Effects is used in the movie industry. One example is that with the movie Avatar, that movie, as far as I'm aware, was completely edited in After Effects. You can correct me if I'm wrong, but I am wrong.
No, we don't. That was a wow. We share the potential surprise in that assessment.
Yeah, a lot of people, they treat it as for example, everybody thinks that because you can download or bootleg Photoshop, that anybody can do Photoshop. Sure, anybody can do Photoshop, but the fact of the matter is, just because you can use Photoshop doesn't mean you're good at it. So same thing applies to video editing. I mean, just because you're doing video editing doesn't mean that you're a master at it. You have to have the experience, and you have to know what you're doing. Otherwise, it is just a toy.
Yeah, it takes that time, definitely. Just to give you a little background, I've actually am starting my 11th year working in After Effects. So I've dealt with all the quirks and the hiccups of, the good and the bad on that side. And once you get to know anything, software, it doesn't matter. The better you know it, the better you get at it.
And all the other plugins, too. I don't think we can really undersell the fact that After Effects, as is used in our office, is so far away from what you buy in a box that, the idea, when the very short comment we made before of, is this plugin going to work with this other plugin? That's a very real conversation we have every day. That this plugin is supposed to make tracking easier, and it does solves in 3D space, but it doesn't understand what, for example, that kind of like grid plugin that we use for Waiting for the End is. So if you render something, it won't look at all like you expect. There's a lot of additional software that you're learning that resides within After Effects.
And just learning the combinations too, because some plugins don't play nice with others. And long process of trial and error. And it's just, experience. You learn that over time. Every time a render crashes or something, you start to figure out what's not working.
A good way to think about it is, I'm sure that a lot of the people listening here are fairly connected. And as someone here before, a lot of us have heard of how Pixar uses Maya to do their rendering. Saying that Pixar uses Maya, from most people's here's understanding of Maya, is not in the same application. I'd use a fairly similar kind of linking for for you know the way that we use After Effects. It was After Effects at one point in time. It's just it's something else now.
It's like a NASCAR. It's you know the Toyota Camry that's being driven at 180 miles an hour around a track. Technically, it looks like a Camry, but it's so far away from a Camry, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Like, you know, they call it that, but at the end of the day, it's all custom made, it's all custom built, it's all new parts. And I think that's a pretty apt description. And last comment, you know, if you look at DreamWorks, they build their own software to do their animated stuff. So there's literally a point at which you buy something in a box and you completely recode it to do what you want it to do. And we're somewhere between out of the box and custom coded.
And speaking of custom coding, I've been meaning to get back to this one question somebody asked. In the middle of one of your answers, I think it was maybe about 5 or 10 minutes ago, you guys very quickly shouted out a website that people can download scripts for After Effects. I know probably it costs you know a lot of money to buy it, but for those people who you know have decent pockets and wish to you know expand their horizons, can you mind shouting out that website again really quick?
You don't necessarily have to have deep pockets as well. There's quite a few scripts on there that are free or name your own price in addition to actually paid. So there definitely are some options. It's called AE, the letters A and E for After Effects, and the word scripts.com.
S-C-R-I-P-T-S.
Yes.
Okay. I'm not great with the spelling.
We spell by committee over here, just so you guys understand.
I make pictures.
And I've got a couple of contributions that I have posted up on that site. As well as even video tutorials elsewhere. And but then there's a lot of stuff that's on that site that you can grab that it just totally makes any workflow so much more tolerable in After Effects and just dealing with everything.
And also, if you see a script on there, I'm going to do the obligatory be good here. If you see a script on there that is awesome and you think it's going to make your life better and it's a name your own price, don't put 2 cents. That's insulting.
Take it free or pay something.
Exactly.
For it.
Yeah. Absolutely. It's a slap in the face when somebody does that.
So. You're just wasting yours, PayPal, and that person's time by doing 2 cents.
Yeah. Yeah, because after PayPal takes the funds out, there's not even anything left.
Exactly.
So,
exactly.
I mean, I know that very well because I work in an antique business, and when people pay me over eBay, you know, if I sell something for $500, PayPal takes out like somebody says put 5 cents instead. No, right. Don't do that. No. PayPal, they take out, you know, sometimes $30, $40. Now, we're just kind of freewheeling it with the questions here now. Somebody talked about Blender. Do you guys ever use Blender, or are you strictly Maya-based for your 3D modeling?
I touched Blender a long time ago, personally, just kind of fooling around with it, but I honestly, I didn't spend a whole lot of time with it. Kind of felt it was a little convoluted, and since it wasn't so user-friendly up front, I kind of gave up on it, so I didn't quite give it a chance personally. But
we haven't really revisited it recently. It's been hard. It's kind of one of those things where once you're in a relationship, you're not really looking around the same way. We're pretty committed to C4D over here, and it works so smoothly with After Effects. Those two just get along so nice. And so once you have software that actually works in harmony pretty well, you don't want to screw with something that works. The little Final Cut, After Effects, and C4D, golden triangle that we have going on over here has made our lives a lot better.
And the C4D, by the way, I don't think we've said it yet. It's Cinema 4D, which is just comparatively it's like the After Effects of 3D applications in that it's very accessible. It can do a lot of things.
Lots of animation based stuff.
Yeah.
Great rendering capabilities and. The longer the application's out there, the more cool stuff you're seeing for it.
Right.
Well, I mean, and another thing is that I don't think a lot of people really realize when they look into it just how much goes into making these videos. You know, a good example, I was talking to you guys before the podcast. One of my favorite indie bands out right now is MGMT, and, you know, I was very excited to find out you guys have and don't mind that question in the chat. That there was a inappropriate Photoshop of me that was done by somebody who got previously banned, and they're talking about that. But anyways,
well, the two questions before that, by the way, are good questions as well that can tie into what you're saying now.
Oh yeah, that's basically what I was actually going to lead into. You know, I was very excited to find out you guys did the video for Electric Feel. And you know, although you know we try to, you know, make sure that this question, these questions, you know, can be understood by people who don't even do what you guys do. I want to also, you know, play to the nerds and the geeks in this chat. So I mean, if you guys can, if you can, you know. No, I'm not mad at you guys. I think it's funny. Sorry, I was responding to something in the chat. If you guys could, you know, walk us through what goes from point A to point B. I mean, what goes into, you know, creating these videos, creating the special effects. I mean, if you can walk us through the process from start to finish, that'd be great. You know, that way people can understand really how much you guys do.
All right. Well, so, I mean, essentially, you know, we touched a little bit on this before, where essentially, you know, we have our initial conversations with, you know, with the powers that be. Video gets greenlit, and essentially, from there, we like getting involved in pre-production as quickly as possible, so that way we can help get the actual footage that we need. That's a huge, huge part of this. We always go through and basically make sure that the footage that we're getting is actually usable for the effect that we want to do. So that's the huge kind of, that's the initial kind of hurdle we get over. Once we get over that, we kind of break things down. In the post-process, you know, if you go overarchingly, Matt was so kind enough to actually give me a quick little bullet line here of like in its most basic form, so once everything's shot on set, you offload all the footage, then you offline, then you do an offline edit of the entire thing using, you know, a smaller proxy of the files so it works a little faster. You take those proxy files, which are smaller than the original kind of full-res raw media, and shift that over to an online version. At that point, we basically jump into the VFX itself and start taking those full online clips and start, you know, doing our appropriate VFXing. And then the final stages that we'll do is we'll do our final color and look pass over the whole thing, and then output and lay to tape. So that's like the basic kind of like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 of the whole thing. But the process itself, I mean, it changes so dramatically every single time that we do a project, really based upon the look that we're going for. I mean, half the time, you know, we do stuff, we're kind of building an effect that we haven't seen yet, really. The way we do things is we're not really a big keyframe animation house. Now, when I say that, it's not like we scrub to 20 frames in and move this, then scrub another 20 frames in and move that. We basically, between Dave and I specifically, we do a lot of scripting and basically algorithm-based animation, where we let the machine kind of animate stuff for us. We've always been kind of fascinated with analog. And we've realized that we've kind of managed to find a way to tap into almost like a digital analog to a certain degree by having the computer also animate with us. Rather than us sitting there and keyframing this, you know, 35 shots, we find the right mathematical algorithm that allows us to have the machine animate that element for us over the process of the video. So again, we can concentrate more on the design process and let the machine almost animate for us as well.
And there was a question previously about waiting for the end and the way that was shot. The person who asked the question, and I haven't scrolled up, but because we knew the effect that we wanted to do on that, which was basically this kind of particle effect with basically, and Brandon and Dave can explain it better, but using the luminosity value, using the light value in the shot to create the effect, we knew that's how it would work. So basically what we asked the band to do was don't do an elaborate shoot. Find a small space, do a single light source so that it falls off to black, do a black background. And by shooting it in that exact way, the process Brandon was just talking about of an automated system by which the computer actually takes the data and does with it what you want, we were able to skip 10 steps in the process. There was no keying, there was no kind of preliminary color or lighting changes that needed to be done. We were able to shoot exactly what was needed to pull that effect off. That is exceptionally different than something like Burning in the Skies, where you go to a house. Actually, anecdotally, that house in Burning in the Skies is our office. you got to know that. So if you watch that video again, you know, each of those locations is somewhere inside of our office. But that's a real location. That's a real place. So the type of effects you do from there is, you know, integrating or layering over that footage. which is very different than Waiting for the End, which is very different than parts of Catalyst. The Catalyst or the concert footage. So kind of each part of it, you know, basically the bullet list that Brandon just went over, the VFX part could be an infinitely different process from time to time. It's just the rest of it, the whole offload footage to offline edit, to onlining, to color, to output, that's all relatively standard, and you kind of know what you're getting into.
I think there's a kind of a default general process that a lot of people think about where you go out, you film something, you bring that stuff into the computer, and then you alter that to then create an effect and then output it. And there's an alternative process that we keep kind of jumping into where we're actually, the stuff that we go film is actually part of the effect process. Like we're actually keeping in mind what we're trying to create at that point. So even when we're filming the footage, that itself is becoming an effect that then in turn comes to step two once it's actually in the computer and gets processed even further. So,
and there was a question previously about shooting on film versus digital. I'd say 90%, 95% of what we've been working on lately is digital formats. The only difference in kind of that bullet list would be the telecine process, which is essentially if you shoot on 35 or 16 or even 8 or Super 8 or whatever, you would take it to a Company 3 or a Rush's type place. By the way, Company 3 is they do color and looks passes to movies like Transformers and Avatar. They're a big company in town. They will essentially capture the film and lay it to
a digital media
that then we would take from there. So that's just adding another group to the process. But film is very expensive, and in the world that we're in now, there are a lot of people who are just shooting Red or Alexa or Weiss or Phantom or Genesis or whatever it is,
yeah,
that are cameras that, to 99% of the public don't look any different than film. And the digital format, to Brandon's credit, I'll throw in that adding film grain and the looks pass that make thing look filmic without being shot on film is something that we spend a lot of time on here as well, so that you can't really tell what the raw shooting format was.
I also hate keying film. It's always grainy. It never works out.
It looks beautiful, and directors and DPs will literally rip your throat out to get it on film because they don't believe that you can make it look like film on the back end. But frankly, that just makes our lives harder, and we don't like that.
Very nice. I'm not sure if this is from the chat or if this is just one of our own questions.
It's from Facebook.
Oh, it's from Facebook. Okay, great. Usually Mike and Joe are really involved with the visuals considering their pretty much the creative powerhouse of the band. To what extent would you say the rest of the band is involved as well? Do they simply input ideas, or would you say they have a bigger role?
They tend to serve as kind of a collective voice of reason, I think, throughout the process. I know especially like when we were having initial talks about the imaging and kind of branding process that the new album would be going through. The guys were actually fairly outspoken. They really wanted to be involved. They wanted to be a part of this. This was kind of a, they were kind of going into new territory with this new album, and they really wanted to kind of have their piece heard. They don't necessarily go into the same level of detail and minutia that that Joe and Mike will dig into when it comes to the visuals, but overarching stuff they definitely want to have their hand in. Brad, I know specifically, like he's. I mean, you want to talk about a quick wit on someone. He if he doesn't think that this is pretty cool looking, he will let you know very, very quickly. Don't consider it in any other way besides, he'll say, I think it's going to kind of be lame. And he'll just come right out and say it. So they'll, they have no problem kind of weighing into it, but they were there at every single one of the major meetings when we were kind of showing updates and showing what we're up to. Talking about this idea or that concept, everyone was there. Everyone was present.
And, during each approval process, we'll get the most notes from Joe and from Mike throughout the process. But when it comes down to, putting out something to the public to look at, we wait for comments from every single one of the band members to basically say, these are my thoughts, these are my notes, I'd like to see this addressed. And, that's part of a conversation that, always being time sensitive, because I saw a question about, you know, the pressure that these projects are under.
Lots.
But definitely everybody gets their 2 cents in or their 10 cents in or whatever it is, so that there isn't one person in the process who feels as though their voice has not been heard.
This is playing into a question I was asked by someone. I mean, I know you guys didn't work on Cloverfield, but you wish, exactly. Have you guys ever been approached by any major studios to help with video editing? And if not, is that something you guys might want to do one of these days? You might want to be one who like edits and processes a movie, or do you think that just might be a little too much?
There's no such thing as too much. That's a huge misnomer. I'll even use that as a jumping point for anyone who thinks about who's trying to do anything out there creatively. There is no too much. We don't know any better than we've gotten exactly where we are because we don't say that that's too much or that we don't belong there. Look, we're a bunch of dudes who are very simple people. And we've just managed to bumble and stumble our way to this exact point in time, thankfully making decent enough decisions along the way. So there is no such thing as too much. With that being said, no, we haven't done too much film stuff. We're that's actually starting to kind of pick up a little bit. We're starting to hear more from people who want to see some of our stuff on a bigger format, and we'd love to. I don't know if it's really our identity at this point to say that we're going to be doing... we look at an avatar or something like that, and I know for me that doesn't really connect. I don't see what I do being what that is. Now for someone like Dave, who is a more proper VFX guy, and for Jeff, who's away, they're definitely more VFX guys, and I'm sure they'd love to dive into that kind of stuff a little more. For me, I'm more of a design guy, and so... I look at places like Prologue, Digital Domain, and some of those kind of animals, and I can't really get into that, like opening titles and that kind of stuff. By the way, if you guys want to look at some really really cool visuals, this group Prologue, centered out of Santa Monica, every single time that you've seen an awesome opening or closing credits that you're like, wow, that was better than the movie. It was Prologue. Those guys are insane. And the hours they work there are should be illegal. I mean, people, you want to talk about a nose first grind. People work their asses off there, but they make incredible work.
And, I think I'll try to answer a question that's popped up a couple times, because this leads into, there have been a couple questions about how much pressure are these jobs under. We're working the music video world. Somebody asked about commercials. We do commercial work. But for example, the first project we did with Linkin Park, pressure-wise, and this feeds into the film industry of amplifying this story by 1,000 times would be our reality if we were in that. So it kind of feeds into, do we want to do that? Yeah, but there's kind of a quality of life that may change. So, but with our first project for New Divide, that shot in mid-May 2009, and then they wanted to deliver the video, I think on June 11th, it was something like that. So between the shoot date and the delivery date, there was about 3 weeks. And that included the time to actually edit the video.
Which is what, about a week and a half, 2 weeks?
Yeah, and so we had, I think we did the visual effects for New Divide in 9 days. Nine days for the visual effects for that.
I think I slept somewhere in there.
So ultimately for that project, talking about pressure, that was all tied to a MySpace exclusive release for the video, tied into marketing for the soundtrack through Paramount's music division, Warner's music division through the band, exclusive interviews and kind of release of that video for the soundtrack, for all this different stuff. So we had to deliver it. MySpace had an exclusive, which I'm sure you guys saw, at 5 p.m. local time for an 8 p.m. release on the East Coast. It needed to be on MySpace at 5 p.m. And we were outputting it that day. At 4:15, we had an output that was 10 megabytes too big for MySpace to use.
So we had
to output it. And at 4:45, I personally drove with a hard drive to Warner's office for them to stream it directly to MySpace. And at 4:58 p.m., and we had the commissioner calling, we had Paramount's music division calling.
My mom was calling.
Everybody was calling, everybody was freaking out, and it got uploaded 75 seconds before the release. That's when the video went to MySpace. Now, that's the kind of pressure after 9 days of not sleeping, of dealing with not only the label, but Paramount's music division to tie in, you know, with conversations with Michael Bay. You know, that was our first introduction to Linkin Park. That was our first introduction to Joe and to Bill and to the management team, you know, Ryan and Jordan and all those guys. So there's quite
a bit. This, you know.
So somebody asking about the pressure, you know, that's a story that, you know, was our first project with them. So there we go.
And sadly, at that point in time, that really wasn't all that stressful.
Yeah. Yeah.
Things have gotten better since then.
Go ahead.
I've got a quick question. You said you've done commercials. Anything notable that we might know?
As of late, it's been Fandango.
If you guys go to whatever Fandango tied-in theater is, because it's either Pacific or AMC theaters, you'll see the little kind of like burning head bag guys, the bag dolls. And they do ads for, like, Avatar and all those. We did those. The singing paper bags.
I apologize in advance for that.
Yeah.
What else?
Rhapsody. We did a couple commercials for Rhapsody.
Jay-Z Rhapsody. Also Green Day Rhapsody as well. They kind of pop up and go back down again. BlackBerry. Beats by Dre. Motorola.
Red Bull spots.
With Red Bull, we worked with them for about a year or so, doing a bunch of different stuff. And the most recent stuff has been actually EA. We've done their recent MMA commercial and Medal of Honor. Is that right?
Yeah, Medal of Honor.
And Medal of Honor,
which are both Linkin Park tie-ins through Joe and through the band and management.
Right. So we kind of filtered around a little bit, we're actually in the midst of a commercial project right now. So, they kind of pop up and pop back down again. We have kind of a specific look to us, I'd say. So it's a very specific kind of client that kind of wants us.
And on that note, we did some work for Victoria's Secret's Swim 10 campaign last year.
You must have been happy.
Yeah, looking at that footage, I will admit, was a step up from what we normally get to look at.
I can stare at that for 12 hours a day on a computer. So.
But, you know,
she stayed pretty.
Victoria's Secret has a distinct look. Obviously, if you have seen any of their commercials, it's very clean, it's very elegant, it's very beauty-based. And we stepped in and tried to do something a little bit more designerly, a little bit more kind of creating a look beyond just their standard fare that you would see on broadcast. And, you know, they were reluctant to do it, but there were a couple spots, and I think we have a couple on our website if anybody's looking to see them. But, you know,
ghosttownmedia.com.
Yeah, ghosttownmedia.com.
And that is the sound of your website crashing.
But
I just built that thing.
But with echo Brandon's point, we have a look. We want to take things that are really beautiful and destroy them in really beautiful ways. You can get an exceptionally shot, really beautiful, really well color corrected, and really well lit picture from anyone. But there's a kind of design or an aesthetic that we think we can bring to the table, that Brandon and Dave and Jeff and our team can bring to the table, that you might not otherwise get. And we want to kind of find clients willing to do that.
We like broken.
Yeah, broken in a beautiful way is, I think, the quickest way to describe what we like to look at.
Well, you know, before the podcast began, someone had asked if you mind boob questions, and in a way, you kind of did answer that because you brought up Victoria's Secret, so you did technically do that.
Yeah, no, that's been in the back of our mind the whole time. Yeah.
Okay, here's a good question. As good as the Madrid show was, you know, a Madrid show is definitely special in, you know, circumstance. There was a lot of people in the crowd. It was one of the first big performances the band had done in their album. There's a lot of people who were really into the Madison Square Garden show, specifically for the fact that, you know, it was, even though it was a big, big venue, it was still in a way kind of more intimate because, you know, there was all these fans that were there for the show, all these people that, you know, got special tickets just to be there so they could be on camera. A lot of people were wondering, do you have any idea? I know they're making, you know, a European release, but Do you know if the band has made any intents, or should I say, any ideas to make a North American tour DVD? Do you think that's in the works, or is that kind of something that they haven't really talked about?
We haven't heard anything on that yet. I know that for the MSG show, that one was made available through Fuse. That was a direct contract with them, I believe, for that show. So I believe that a lot of the control and some of the details of that are going to have to get worked out between the boys' management, Warner Brothers, and Fuse will probably end up being the deciding factors of whether or not that show lives on in some kind of a solid form media format. But I would definitely say that the guys are really proud of what they've been able to do thus far, and I don't know that we're finished yet. So I think it's likely that that we'll probably end up seeing more releases and more video of some of their live stuff going out there. But again, nothing specifically has been mentioned nor really put together thus far.
Yeah, and to defer those questions, and we want to answer as much as we can, but for stuff like what DVDs are going to be released,
it's under NDA.
Yeah, no, we just don't know. I mean, they'll usually call us and say, hey, we want to do this. And for example, the Live in Madrid DVD, they said, hey, we want to put this out. Can you help us out with some of the effects? And then we obviously hop on board. But for their future plans as to how they want to release media and DVDs and behind the scenes and stuff, we just are not in the know on that. We're kind of last to know just before it's released. So,
well, that kind of answered a question I had. I was wondering if you're going to release the music videos on Blu-ray, because YouTube, even if they're in 1080p, compresses the heck out of them. Do you know if there are plans to release those videos on the internet on perhaps another service where they're not going to be so compressed and it could do your work justice?
I haven't heard anything like that yet. I haven't heard anything along those lines yet. I do know that, a lot of the videos, we'll do a little bit of internal plug on that. A lot of the videos that are currently up on YouTube that have been kind of compressed in that horrendous YouTube because you have some middle management guy uploading it, we've actually painstakingly uploaded and put to our own site. So, and they're all the LP material that we've ever worked on, that's been commercially released, is currently up on our site in 1080 format. So if you don't like the quality of the YouTube stuff, you can always look over at ours, and we're pretty proud of the quality we've been able to upload. But in terms of a commercial release, I have not heard of anything in the lines of that yet. But, as always, stay tuned. It's always subject to change, and probably will.
All right, yeah, I'll check that out, because those videos on Blu-ray would be amazing.
Oh, that'd be great.
Yeah, we personally, outside of the reality of whether or not they do it, we'd love to see it. I think it would be kind of an interesting exercise to put out, the A Thousand Suns kind of cycle of visuals as a Blu-ray. Everything, music videos, promotional stuff, anything that's tied in, I think we'd personally like to see it out there, but, that's not our call, I guess.
I mean, if you guys had a choice, again, you guys aren't the band, and, I had to at least bring these up once. You guys made the really, really, really incredible tour visuals for the A Thousand Suns tour. I know that it's currently surrounded by a whole lot of red tape, and there's not a lot you can say about that. But, if you guys had a choice, if preferably, because I'm sure the band might even be listening in for all we know, would you want to see those visuals on a Blu-ray down the line? Is that something that you guys hope you could see on a Blu-ray? I think, even up on the internet in 1080p, with all the work that you guys put into it, I just don't think it's doing it justice. So
we're really proud of what we made. We're always critics of our own work. Basically, most anything we make, we immediately start ripping apart as soon as we deliver it to someone. So of course, I already have 2 pages of notes of what things I'd like to change and stuff. But we're proud of what we did, and people seem to like it. People seem to be interested in it, and I like when creative effort is shared. If there's any way for that stuff to get out there in any format better than an iPhone video that of some drunken person in a crowd, that would be awesome. That would make me happy in my life.
And hey, if you guys get to release those officially, we'd love to be the place that releases that, just saying, so.
Duly noted.
Yeah.
Duly noted. Good, good, good. All right. Are you guys usually given a vision for the videos, or are you guys usually the ones who are in charge of coming up with the concept? That's a good question.
No, Joe comes in, and I definitely want to make sure that we don't misconstrue our role here. Joe comes in knowing where, kind of where he wants this to kind of exist. And so he'll come in with kind of his baseline idea. And then from, it's actually funny. We'll almost do like a show and tell thing where Joe will come in with his basic idea of his idea and some ideas and visuals and things like that. And then we'll sit on that for a little bit. And then we'll kind of come back with him with more visuals of like, oh, okay, so we found this stuff too, which is kind of cool. Does this make sense to you? And then kind of from there, we kind of whittle down everything that everyone's super excited about. And this is mostly for the post-heavy stuff. For Burning the Skies, Joe knew what he wanted to do with that one. So while we kind of popped in and out of there on that one, that was a lot of Joe on that.
Joe writes the treatments. Joe comes up with the concepts. And then that sets the parameters through which we sit with him and with Bill and say, okay, within this box, within this creative space, here's some ideas, and that's where the conversation starts.
Exactly.
So, to Brandon's point of, we're not concepting this stuff. Every once in a while, we'll have a chance to kind of get in on the pitching ideas ground floor. But, this is, as far as directing the videos, this is Joe's show. He runs it. He does his thing. And we play as much support as he wants, or as the creative team wants, on each project.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of what we do is we do a lot of stopgap and fill in kind of stuff of like, because a lot, frankly, just in the process of experimentation that we do over here, a lot of stuff is kind of like whittled together on the fly, and we'll be like, hey, this looks kind of cool. And if Joe's like, yeah, that looks kind of cool, then sweet, we have something that we move forward with. And if he's like, yeah, that's kind of lame, then we're like, oh, okay. And then we move forward.
Yeah. And to jumping in on the, there was another question about VHS or DVD before. Just as far as experimentation goes for the meeting with Thousand Suns, just to give you guys an idea of how some of that was created, we actually had a station of analog devices like camcorders or Pixel Vision cameras or soundboards with modulating pieces that you would pipe sound through and it would spit out visuals.
We also had a circuit bent TI something or other from like, I think it was like 79, that someone had basically circuit bent the whole system and turned it into kind of a big glitch box. So we'd pipe video and basically have different dial tones that we could hit on it, and different combinations of settings would give you different kind of pulse patterns. So we were able to actually being able to harvest like real lifetime digital fuckery, sorry for the language. To
you can curse all you want. I'm surprised this is the first big curse on the podcast.
We're trying to be good here. But to that point, because I know that there's kind of a conversation going on now of the merits of old technology and whether or not they still have a place. As far as what you put out to the public, maybe not, but we definitely have fallen in love with really analog formats of creating effects. I mean, the documentary especially, that's a lot of real-time filtering of, we would make a VHS tape of a segment of the documentary and put it through a video loop to get some of the effects on top of it. So whether or not those effects were your cup of tea, I know that a lot of people look at it and go, it's too distracting or whatever it is. But what we were trying to do was basically integrate real-time feel of what the media was doing to the media, so to speak. And, that's kind of how we experiment. We love doing that kind of stuff.
Another good question, branching off of that. In regards to, doing the special effects, there's a lot of points during the 1,000 Suns DVD. It's just a kind of a weird out there question. There's a lot of times when the band will be saying something and then kind of like in a cute way, like you guys like put a black box over their mouth and like censor it. Was that because of legal? Like, were you not allowed to, were they not allowed to say those things on DVD, or is that just kind of like a neat concept you guys came up with just to kind of add it to more mystery? Like anything that was there to do with Warner or like Electronic Arts, like all of a sudden I'm going like, beep, was that because you guys were required to do that, or was that just like a cool idea you guys came up with?
Well, legally, you shouldn't be necessarily besmirching clients that you're dealing with. So there was
oh,
that
can't concern. Comment. Okay, no, never mind.
No. What I'm saying actually is like, you know, the guys might be saying something that could be seen in such a way that makes the people that they're working with not look great. And and this is the big thing is that with, you know, a lot of the context of stuff is lost on the editing room floor. And what we didn't want to do, and what the guys didn't want to do, is make it look like they're just lambasting everyone out there in the world. So a lot of that was, you know, wanted to make sure that no one was kind of getting blasted in the course of the DVD. You know, because when you're in an argument or when you're in a heated conversation about like the creative vision of of what your group's going towards, and someone brings up, you know, a commercial client that you're dealing with when you're trying to just get the album done, it's going to be very easy to say, I don't give a god, you know, and rip that person a new, you know, a new what's it. But, so there definitely was that concern. But the footage was really good. And what was happening in that room was really important. And we wanted to get that stuff across. We didn't want to just make it look like, oh, you know, we're just going to walk in and we, on Tuesday, we wanted to make an album, and on Thursday, it was done. Like, this thing was a process these guys went through. And we wanted that to come through. So sometimes we had to use footage that didn't have everyone always in the most handsome light possible, but we want to make sure that went through. And we tried to have a sense of humor about the whole thing in the process as well. You know, so rather than trying to subtly just dip out the audio. No, like we're clearly bleeping something out. You know, we're not fooling anyone in the room. So, you know, we like having a sense of humor about the way we do things.
And as far as the documentary, because obviously there were things that needed to be taken out for content, but there was also kind of the way things were bleeped, and Brandon just touched on it, worked as part of the narrative. What was the goal of how all of the glitch effects and the audio drops and the noise worked was to give the audience some sort of subconscious or subliminal idea of doing what the band was doing, creating a new album that's very different than anything they've ever done before by their own admission, is an unsettling and emotionally distressful process. And what we were trying to do is convey some of that distress onto the viewer as well. We were trying to push that through the screen and make you almost feel uncomfortable at parts of, man, this is really hard to watch. I wonder how hard it was to actually go through this process, to spend a year of your life and take this risk and put something out there that is creatively validating, but maybe not what the fans are expecting or want. I think a lot of those effects jumped into that headspace of trying to create that unsettling nature, trying to show you how information is lost or changed or distorted or defamed or whatever it is on their end, and how it comes through to what you're seeing as a person sitting on your couch watching. So there was a creative element to it in addition to a necessary kind of
evil
part of it.
You guys, touching on something you said, I'm not sure if this was just really down to editing or if it was really how it was. One scene in particular that's very uncomfortable to watch in that DVD is the final scene. I mean, you just see the guys all sitting around, you know, just having this look of stress on their face, you know, looking like before that footage came on that they had just gone through this, you know, terrible argument. And it's kind of a powerful narrative in the DVD itself, where Chester just goes and makes this huge speech about how, you know, they're tired of complying to what everyone else wants them to do. They're tired of making the music that their label or other people say they should make, and, you know, and they just feel that they need to go back to the mind frame that they had, or the mindset in the beginning of the album, in the beginning of their time with the Hybrid Theory LP, where they just make the music they want to make. And I think the editing and just the whole tone of that last scene really, more so than anything, really hit the message hard that the band really was stretched to their limits. And I mean, there was a lot of people you know, I'm not going to make you comment on what you think it meant, but there's a lot of people who are thinking that that was the band almost breaking up, and who knows? I mean, only the band knows what happened then, but, you know, it was just a very intense scene, and, you know, I think you guys did a good job taking what's normally a making-of DVD and turning it into something different, because, you know, instead of doing a normal making-of, you made it, like, what they went through, and it really was an eye-opening to a lot of people.
Yeah, I think from our perspective, that was the goal from the start. You know, we started seeing this footage, and we've all seen, you know, behind-the-scenes stuff of your favorite band, and, you know, it's kind of just a chronology of 2 months ago they did this, and then a month ago they did this, and then yesterday they did this, and then the album came out, and everybody got their checks, and the fans got their album, and all that good stuff. And, you know, I think when kind of our editing team and I think our kind of creative team looked at that footage, you know, we saw it as an opportunity to kind of take away the arm's length transaction that a normal documentary or making of is made up by, and kind of try to integrate the fan into the good and bad part of recording an album. And for a band that's as big as Linkin Park is, you know, you turn it up to 11 and just see what happens. And, you know, we definitely took that to heart. And, you know, I think that may have been lost on some viewers. Okay. You know, we took some risks with it and we tried to do some things that were unconventional and weird and off-putting. And
the whole documentary is about risk.
Yeah.
If you miss that one simple notion of the whole thing's about risk. You know, we took a risk in terms of how we wanted to portray it and the synesthetic kind of emotions we were trying to get out of you. But at the same time, like, the guys were taking a risk. Like, this is the thing, is that these guys didn't have to do this. They didn't have to change up the sound. They could have released, you know, Meteora 2, Cruise Control, and a lot of fans would have absolutely loved it. They would have been like, awesome! But the guys, you know, we all change over time, and the guys are getting older, and everyone matures, and they wanted to take a more introspective approach, I think, with this album than they may have been allowed to previously. And they felt like they had done so many things in their past that they wanted to try to do something a little bit for themselves to a certain degree with this, and this is a scary thing for them because they didn't necessarily, not everyone's always supportive of change, you know, and that's a scary thing. We were trying to help show, we were trying to help kind of show that fear and that risk that was being taken. And, you know, these guys have been together for years now, and are they going to get into arguments? Sure they are. You know, I mean, for those of you here, like, who are in a relationship, there's plenty of fights that you have that you're like, wow, this could be, like, you know, if someone viewed just this one fight inside a vacuum, they'd think that, you know, that you as a couple were done, you know, and if you view that thing without context, that final scene, you're like, wow, I don't even know how many albums there is, you know? But it's not that. It's just, it is a tense time with a lot on the line, and they're trying to do something kind of honest and free to a certain degree. Didn't mean to rhyme. And yet, even with that, there's still a lot of control that is placed on them by other people, and a lot of directing that the world kind of wants to push them in. And it was just a frustrating moment for them.
And, you know, I think, I'm not putting words in the band's mouth, but one of the things we say over here a lot of times, and what we tried to do with the documentary itself, was when you finish watching it, the idea is we want you to either love it or hate it, but don't feel indifferent about it.
Yeah.
So if you think it's a change for the worse, that's fine. If you think it's a change for the better, that's great. But don't just watch it and then forget about it, because that is a waste of our creative time, of the band's creative time, of, okay, moving on to something else in my life equally mundane. You want somebody to have an opinion of it. So, you know, we tried something risky, the band tried something risky, and we wanted to portray that risk in some way so that the audience got inside that headspace, whether they realize it or not.
And that's pretty much, you know, really the way I looked at it too. You know, I mean, the band started something a little risky based on their previous sounds. Like you said, they could have done Meteora Part 2, But, you know, the band decided that it was time to stop doing what everyone else expected them to do and just make their own music. Surprisingly, we never really even asked you this question. We usually ask this the first question we ask. Before, you know, you really got involved with Linkin Park, I mean, would you say that any of you guys were hardcore fans of the band, that you guys, like, listened to them regularly? I mean, did anybody go, like, oh, my God, Linkin Park's on the phone? Or was it just basically, I mean, do you guys, like, listen to, like, a different genre of music? Or one guy seemed to know a lot about Meteora, so...
Right. Well, I mean, you know, I can speak for all the guys here. I mean, we all, you know, I mean, we all had Hybrid Theory, and I think we all here have Meteora. I mean, you know, we all grew up with the band, and it was surreal when I realized that I have Joe sitting in the room with me, and the first time, you know, the first time that you're on set with, like, Chester, and you're talking to Mike, and you're exchanging ideas with these guys, and you're like, holy crap, like, these are people that, like, I was screaming their lyrics, like, not that long ago. And, so there is kind of a, you know, a star striking that happens with some of this stuff. We're all over the place with music, though. I kind of play the violent dictator of music for the VFX room. I'm a bit of an audiophile. I'm constantly getting new albums all the time and trying to uncover new sounds and new artists, new albums. I've tasked myself over here with kind of trying to be ahead of the curve with some stuff. I feel like I fail most of the time, but because I do so much of the aesthetics over here, I'm trying to kind of stay on top of what the cultural pulse is, and I feel like that's part of the reason of kind of what helped my understanding. For, you know, when we first listened to 1,000 Suns, is all of a sudden, like, you know, I'll be frank, I hadn't necessarily listened, you know, to some of the more recent stuff, and then I was like, hey, this stuff sounds like things that I currently have. Like, hey, I'm listening to Sleigh Bells right now, and there's a lot of similarity in the sound. That's awesome. Like, these aren't the same people that I feel like I had checked in with a couple years ago, and that was kind of fun for me, because I was able to kind of take a fresh take at something, you know, because, I mean, back in the day, you know, Napalm Death and Fear Factory and all, you know, I was definitely your run-of-the-mill, you know, angry teenager to a certain degree. And then I kind of left a lot of that music behind, but it was kind of fun going back, you know, especially when we were doing the concert stuff and, like, you know, and you're doing a song for Paper Cut or for something like that, and you're like, you get almost nostalgic to a certain degree. But I do think that, I think a little bit of the separation that we had as of late with some of the music, I think helped us kind of take a fresh take at them, because I think one of the big things that they were shooting for and we were shooting for is that this would not be what they did last time. That was the bottom line for us. This would not be what they did last time. This would not be the Linkin Park that had been created, packaged, and brought to people thus far. This was going to be something else. This was going to be something new. And be it good, bad, and different, burst into flames, or however, we are going to give everything we had to give them something fresh.
Tying into a question that Keaton had asked in our chat, Keaton's one of our resident administrators. Unfortunately, due to scheduling conflicts, he wasn't able to make it. But he's also an aspiring video editor. You know, he does web design, graphic design, and everything else. But one thing that he's dabbled in a lot is video editing. And a question that he wants to know, for people who haven't quite, you know, gotten to, well, somebody wants to know when you hire him. I'm sure if he sends a resume, you'll consider it. But tying into that, here's the thing. People want to know if they are trying to get into the same field of work you are, if they're trying to get to the same level you guys have gotten, what is some good advice you can give to people who are starting out? I mean, is there any internship programs that you can recommend? Any special colleges you guys can recommend? What could you suggest to people who are trying to do what you guys are doing?
I've got a little background on this, because I started off as a freelancer, and trying to get into this kind of work it's very tricky. It's not for the faint of heart. I don't want to discourage anybody, obviously, because It's worth it once you're there, but it's a long, hard fight to make it happen. And the internship sections, there are quite a few of them out there. They're a little tricky to find, some other than others, but at least it's a foot in the door if you can get a hold of that. But you kind of have to look everywhere.
Yeah, it's also
work long hours for free.
Yeah. I mean, this is the thing too.
Willing to be a slave for a little bit of time.
Yeah, Dave and I took kind of different routes into the like the nuts and bolts portion of this career. I actually used to work in broadcast, and my background was in, as we said, fine arts and print design, logo and branding, and that kind of stuff. And then I kept having film kids that kept asking me to do VFX, and all of a sudden I found myself in broadcast doing that kind of stuff. And basically, I'd managed to basically save up enough money that I was like, okay, I can jump out and try this being an independent creative for a little while and see how it works. And basically, I had to put together a nest egg to be able to live off of, because when you first come out there, you think you're worth a lot of money, but you have to prove that to everyone else. And that's the bottom line, is that if someone doesn't know you from Adam, then you're not worth anything to them. And you have to prove that initially until you have kind of a big solid reel of work. You have a strong vision. You have experience. These are all things that, you know, start making you worth money. And it's hard. I mean, I can tell you a story of when I had to stay awake for 4 days consecutively. Now, it's not, I'm not kidding about anything about that. I sat at my machine. I walked away twice to take a leak. But I was at my machine working for 4 straight days. And I eventually had to stop working when I started hallucinating that cobwebs were flowing off my screen as if I was underwater, and they put me into a room and laid me down, and I forgot how to eat pizza when they woke me up after that. Like,
we got to a point like where we put food in front of Brandon, because this is one of the first projects I had worked on when we were out here, where we ordered food and we had, what, 7 people who were up for 96 straight hours, and various concoctions of caffeine and Notos and all that other stuff, and we put food in front of Brandon and Jeff, and they didn't know what to do with it. They didn't know were they working with it? Were you eating it? Was it a phone call? Like, literally, this was sleep deprivation induced hallucinating.
Yeah.
That was happening. It was actually kind of scary, but
did you guys like try to play like the airplane, like put in a spoon, goes, here comes the airplane.
I think actually at one point,
yes, we are badass World of Warcraft players, by the way. That's a story for another.
Yeah. It was brutal, but you have to have moments like that, though. Like, you know, as terrible as it was to go through, and it's we can all laugh about it now. I mean, frankly, it earned me a lot of respect of my freelancers working under me, because they realized, oh, okay, if he's saying this, then he's not joking around. He's willing to go the extra mile for me here. But at the same time, you have to take risks, and you have to follow through. That was a scenario where we weren't necessarily thrilled with the position that we've been put into, and people are going to put you in that position all the time. But you have to follow through. If you say you're going to do something, you do it. If you think this looks cool, you have to show that you can make it first. We have a lot of people that talk in this town, and if you can, you have to be able to kind of put up, you know, because I can't tell you how many times we get calls from people saying, hey, so I had these guys, they said they were going to do this. They don't know how to do it. Can you do it? It happens a lot. Don't overextend yourself, you know.
And you have to, honestly, you have to prove to yourself that you're willing to do it too. Like that, that 4-day
bender
shit show, to be honest, I don't know a better way to describe it than that. When we came out on the other side of that, we decided, okay, we're doing this. I mean, you know, that's one of those things where you could wake up one morning and go, you know what? This isn't my thing. I don't want to do it. It's not important enough to me to do that to myself. If you talk to anybody who's been in this industry out here and is doing it professionally, makes their living doing it,
they have one of those stories.
They all have that story. They can all tell you their
make or break moment.
I was at the bottom and I decided to keep going. So that's not to discourage you at all, or to discourage anyone from doing it. It's just be ready for it and just realize it's going to happen, and you fight back on the other side of it, and you understand what you're willing to do, what you're not willing to do, and what you think you can make your life out of this profession.
Just because you're sitting at a computer doesn't mean it's easy.
Yeah. And to kind of add to that story too, I wasn't officially working with Ghost Town full time at that point. During that same project, they were just Matt and Brandon were just talking about, and after that long 96-hour hellacious time, I get this crazy little call from Matt, like I think it was mid afternoon, asking if I could come in because I had done some freelance stuff for him previously, so we kind of had a little connection going there. And I said, yeah, sure, I'll come in and help out. And I just walk into this crazy mess, not realizing that walked in the door, I ended up working a 22-hour shift, just nonstop.
We also didn't pay him. He didn't realize that at the time either.
Well, no, I actually, sadly, I did know that up front.
Yeah, I said that up front to my credit. I told him we need a favor.
Yeah,
not,
I was definitely in the know of it being a freebie job, but... This goes back to wanting to do this type of work. I mean, it definitely is a passion to want to do effects, to do design, to be in this business in general. I mean, if you don't have that passion, it's definitely going to kill you. But, at the time, I also needed to prove to them because I was trying to get into their door. And, that helped.
And from that moment on, Dave was our number one guy. And thereafter, he's full time. He's, one of our project heads here at Ghost Town. So... people will take notice if you're willing to put in the hours with them. It's hard, but the one thing I will say is it's very easy to validate those hours if you, A, feel your work is good, and B, if you're getting feedback from people out in the world who are seeing it. For example, this podcast, the hours and months we spent doing all this work, and, you stay up till 4 a.m. and you start work again at 8 the next morning, it's worth it when you can go on and see... 80 million people have watched your video on YouTube, or, there's sold out shows for 9 months that people want to go see the concert. Now, in that case, they want to see the band, obviously. But, if we're adding to that experience and people are responding positively, that validates those hours. It helps you wake up in the morning with 2 hours of sleep and go do another 22-hour day. And to answer one of your guys' questions, we saw... two shows in Europe. We saw Berlin, the very first show, Berlin and Stuttgart. Brandon, Jeff, and I were over there doing last-minute prep in Berlin for them to get their show off the ground. Brandon saw Madrid, and then we saw Las Vegas and Los Angeles out here in the States. And, yeah, it did really feel good to see the show live. It did. It was very validating to see the whole thing and see people respond so positively to it.
All right. One question I wanted to ask you guys personally was, of course, like you guys are saying, it sounds like as worthwhile as it is for you guys, it's of course very painstaking, and you go through those moments where you're talking really about the hallucination and everything. Was there any one or any group of people, maybe people in the same line of work, or just other people in general who inspire you? I think every line of work that has something as painstaking as you guys described and needs some sort of motivation. Does that come from anyone or anything or any group?
Absolutely. I know for me, I'll jump in first as I've been kind of the ramble box over here. I know for me, like I mentioned Prologue earlier, I'm constantly checking out what they're up to. There's kind of a severity and style they have in their motion works that are, it's just really exquisite, most of the time. For context, these are the guys that did the titles for Sherlock Holmes, for Iron Man, for Tron. The guy who runs the company was actually one of the guys who did the opening title for Seven, that made me want to get into the notion of motion graphics. So, they just do some incredible stuff up there. So I watch them a lot, and I actually... I have a feeder blog that I pull. I go through about 600 different articles and imagery a day before I come into the office. And my favorites of that stuff I actually post up on the Ghost Town blog. as my kind of little founding board. And so every day I'm finding new stuff that I'm like, I wish I made that. I wish I made that. Oh, that's really awesome. So, you know, I feed constantly on new music, on new imagery, on new video. I kind of need it to kind of function to a certain degree. A little vampiric at that, almost to a point of like I have to look at new stuff every day to kind of keep my mind going.
As far as inspiration goes, you know, like Brandon mentioned, there's the blog that he kind of pulls stuff from, and that gets populated kind of to ours. But you know, there are sites like motionographer.com that are pulling, you know, the best in visual effects and design to one kind of central place, where you'll see companies like Motion Theory or PSYOP or Area 51, you know, that are the best of the best, that are putting out those videos and commercials and kind of title projects and, you know, the visual effects work that makes everyone in the industry go, damn, that's fucking awesome. And you want to track what they're doing. And, you know, Motionographer, Ventilate.ca, that's another big one. And then, you know, specifically directors and creative studios, and, you know, we mentioned Motion Theory, PSYOP, those are people that are doing really cool work consistently.
The Mill.
Yeah, The Mill is always fantastic. First Avenue Machine.
Yeah, they're awesome, too.
Is spectacular. And these are people that within our industry, you know, people we would like to be mentioned in the same breath as, to be honest. And, you know, we're looking at that stuff every day. We're constantly kind of, you know, gathering around computers to say, wow, this studio just put out something pretty breathtaking. Could we do that? Are we good enough to do that? Do we have the eye to do that? And, you know, that's the challenge we put ourselves through every day.
Yeah, I mean, we're pretty self-deprecating. We try to put the best imagery in front of ourselves and say, do we want to do that? If so, could we do that? And we try to be very, very honest about it. You know, if we think that there's something that, wow, that's awesome and I have no idea how they did that, you know, chances are you'll see someone freaking out for the next 3 days trying to see if they can find a way to emulate that look or to say, could I do that just with having looked at the final result? You know, we like to do a lot of reverse engineering over here just to see how people think.
Oh, I mean, okay. Here's a good one. We've been talking so much about what you do all the time. What is your favorite interest outside of work? That can be, you know, one of our final questions, if you will.
I like killing squirrels.
I like watching Brandon kill squirrels.
I try to avoid all of that all the years.
Well, here, Matt, why don't you go first, actually? We'll give an honest question.
I honestly, we're pretty nerdy. To be, you know, brutally honest about ourselves, we all...
I'm a geek, thank you.
Until recently, we played video games, World of Warcraft, or we did that kind of stuff as a way to kind of do something outside of the office. And by the way, outside of work is a very, very small amount of time for us.
Yeah. It's getting better, but it's still relatively small.
But, you know, I think, for me personally, you know, I watch movies and as much kind of media as I can get my hands on that I like. I read a lot.
Hey, you're doing poker night.
Yeah, play poker, do some gambling, do that kind of stuff. But, you know, the normal kind of chill and relax and not do work type stuff is where I would fall. Not very interesting, but, you know, it passes the time.
I'm recently married, so I've been doing a lot of the honey-do list has now been created.
He goes to Bed Bath & Beyond a lot.
So awesome. No, honestly, on my free time, I'm going through all those blogs and all those image sources. Like, you know, I'm listening to new music. And if I'm not doing that, I'm probably eating a Chick-fil-A. I like burritos too. You know, but I'm kind of an old cranky man, as it turns out, even though I'm the youngest one in the office, I'm kind of the curmudgeon.
Ironically, people are talking about age in the chat. How old are you guys?
How old am I again?
You're 28.
Yeah, I'm 28.
I'm 30.
I'm 36.
And that's the 28 to 36 is our range.
And for a little bit of context too, I was 22 when I first started, Ghost Town. So for,
yes, he is a youngin.
So in terms of context of age, because I graduated college when I was 21, and then worked in broadcast for like a year or so. So I was like 22, 23 when I first started Ghost Town with Jeff. So just a little bit of extra time. But yeah,
like, totally inspired like so many people in the chat. Everyone's like, this gives me hope, you know.
Yes, there's still a chance.
There's it's about half determination and half obstinance.
Yeah,
I would say, like, if you really want to do it and you're self-confident, you can get into it. And if you're just a stubborn motherfucker, you can make your way through. If you can just continually kind of learn from your mistakes and take your lumps, then you've got a real chance to do something positive. Because, you know, like Brandon and Dave said, if you spend enough time with the software and you just play around with it, you learn it, and you put something out that you hate and you try it again and it's better, then you can learn anything, frankly. It just takes time and determination.
Not to be the guy that quotes Malcolm Gladwell, but I'll be the guy that quotes Malcolm Gladwell. 10,000 hours to become proficient in anything.
Yeah.
If you haven't spent 10,000 hours doing it, then you're still short.
I read that book. That is a fantastic book, by the way. It's called Outliers, that book by Malcolm Gladwell where he says that. Brilliant.
Yeah, it's a really, really good book. I know he's way too fashionable these days, but I actually read his stuff after. Also, again, being a curmudgeon, I always read stuff after everyone says it was popular, if I hadn't caught it beforehand. But really, really good stuff. Those books are great for anyone who is first starting out, because you read about the biggest people in the world, the most successful people in the world. And I think it's also even good to think about, as you think about the guys in the band, like, they're all just people. And, you know, everyone starts somewhere and everyone poops, you know?
Yeah. I love that book.
Somebody just mentioned, what kind of music do we listen to? Brandon is, like he said, our music Nazi in the office. He is constantly forcing new artists on us, a lot of which are pretty spectacular. On an average day, I would guess that in our office you're going to hear somebody you've never heard before, frankly.
Yeah, I mean, my recent musical fetish has been Gobble Gobble. I know it sounds ridiculous as a name, but Gobble Gobble. This kid's insane. He has an album that sounds nothing like his remix work. This kid, I don't even know if he's signed technically with this remix stuff, but he just shreds apart music. He's been cool. We're big Animal Collective fans. Panda Bear. I'm trying to think here. We're doing a lot of Grizzly Bear.
Yesayer. Alaskan Winter.
Yeah, Alaskan the Winter is a great one. And then Bear in Heaven. Lots of animals. We listened to a lot of animal stuff. And then I think if you want to look long view at us, like, we love a lot of the post rock stuff. If you do, like, Godspeed You Black Emperor, Silver Mount Zion, Explosion in the Sky, a lot of that stuff kind of hits a lot of our kind of high notes, I'd say.
And then, you know, being children of the early 90s, you know, Jeff and I especially, you know, you're going to see Tool or Nine Inch Nails, you're going to see Pearl Jam, Soundgarden. You know, we never really grew that far past grunge rock, so...
Yeah.
For more known artists, since we just threw out a bunch that may not hit everybody's radar, you know, early 90s kind of alternative stuff.
Yeah, I mean, we all started there, and then some of us progressed farther than others.
Shut up.
And of course, being the old man, I still got a couple of AC/DC and Metallica sitting around on my shelf at home.
Not wrong with that.
It's the first concert I ever went to.
Stone Temple Pilots, sadly.
It was Metallica down in San Diego.
Metallica!
Anger! Stop.
And I'm seeing Zach is hitting all of our proclivities. I guess the stuff that we play... At the office, we played a lot of Prototype. We played Dead Space 1 and 2, Bulletstorm. Then we have people that are playing, you know, MMOs like World of Warcraft. I'm playing Rift right now, off and on, when I have a free minute here and there.
Nerd.
Resident Evil 5 is around the office.
StarCraft,
Dragon Age, like any of the BioWare stuff, BioShock. Yeah, a lot of that stuff.
No one ever plays Go Fish anymore.
And Mitch Hedberg is awesome, by the way. Yeah, Red Dead as well. Mitch Hedberg is the greatest comedian ever to have lived, even though he's no longer living. That's my opinion.
Yeah, agreed. Thank you.
Well, I should explain. Lewis has a tradition with every podcast. He picks random times to do it, but sometime during the podcast, it doesn't matter if it's not music related at all, he will scream at Metallica. you in particular, you mentioned Metallica, so he thought of the perfect opportunity to just jump in and say it.
Yeah, it was topical.
it's bound to happen every time, so just as a warning. Oh, I also wanted to ask a question, actually. One of you said explosions in the sky, is that correct?
Correct.
They're coming to California. Are you going to go see them?
I might, actually. I was furious that I missed Godspeed. They've actually played in the Los Angeles area twice, and I missed them both times. And as to not think that I'm just a terrible person these days, I may have to go see them as to keep my faith in myself.
And, you know, from my perspective, they did musical scoring for one of my favorite TV shows / movies, Friday Night Lights. You know, if you've seen the movie, obviously Explosions is all over that. And musical cues from that is taken for the TV show. So kind of need to see them in person now that I know that one of my favorite pieces of media on television incorporates their sound.
Yeah,
because I'm going to see them in Oakland in May. So I just thought it was pretty cool that you guys like them. That's all.
Oh, yeah, no, most definitely.
Cool stuff.
Well, I'm kind of looking here. I mean, now that we touched on your personal lives and got to know more about you guys as people... What do you say?
Stop touching.
Nice.
Maybe after dinner, but
listen, it's God's day, okay? Up on the equator.
That was great. See, it's either the guest or one of the moderators. They always try to mess me up at least once during the podcast, and you guys did it, so good work. Well, that in mind, I don't really see any more questions coming in. Somebody wants me to ask if you like ketchup.
Well, Mike has made a mandate to try to catch up, motherfucker, so
yes!
I guess I do.
Yeah!
So yes, we have tried the ketchup.
I was thinking you guys would be completely oblivious to that. So I guess he must have showed you the T-shirt or whatever. I'm assuming.
We do our research.
Yeah, we know what's going on in the world around us sometimes.
Try to make it so we don't have to catch up, motherfucker, too often.
Yeah.
Good, because we want everyone to try the ketchup.
Have you ever seen Mike wearing a T-shirt? That's a good question.
I don't think we have.
No. Usually when I see him, he's all dolled up for the videos. So I don't know if that's officially part of the stylist's garb that they go to.
I think it should be.
Again,
if we can
do
find
a When They Come For Me video, that T-shirt has to be on.
Yeah, if we can find the stylist for the next video ahead of time, we'll let you guys, we'll leak it to the appropriate channels, and you guys can try to get it in there.
Yes. Yes. Very good.
Well, now.
Shots, so we can get some snuck in there with one.
Yeah, no. Yeah. And then one of our t-shirts, too.
Yeah.
I actually think that was the perfect question to close out the podcast with, because, you know, you can't really top that. So, it doesn't look like any other questions are coming in, so I think probably what I'm going to do, because I don't want to take up too much of your time, guys, I'm probably going to close this out. I just really wanted to thank you guys, though, for, coming in and...
Club Tattoo,
of course. I want to thank you guys for coming in and answering all these questions for us and, giving us the opportunity to, answer everything for the fans, getting behind-the-scenes anecdotes behind the videos. Anybody who has been listening into here, I just want to give these guys a quick shout-out. You can find out about all of their work that they do on ghosttownmedia.com. Please be sure to, go on over to their Facebook and add them on facebook.com/GTMVFX. Also, if you are on Twitter, it's the same handle. It's twitter.com/GTMVFX. definitely go ahead and follow
I'm that. Right now.
Yeah, I mean, definitely go ahead and do that because, you know, these guys are really down to earth, as you've seen. You know, they're very awesome guys. These guys need to get their name out there even more. So if you guys are on Facebook or Twitter, be sure to add them. And, of course, you know, to see all the other stuff they do, go on ghosttownmedia.com. You know, thank you guys so much for doing this podcast. And, you know, if you ever have, if you're ever in Hawaii, you know, Keaton wants to join your staff. So,
and from our perspective, obviously, thank you guys for having us, because, you know, it's not that often that we kind of get to sit down and actually tell anybody else about these weird little stories that go on in our day-to-day life. And hopefully they were interesting for everybody listening. And, you know, as far as going to our website, obviously we love when people check out our work, but the blog that we put up is other work that we find inspiring. That's definitely something that if you're looking for something cool to look at every day, go look at it. That's the stuff that other people are doing that, you know, we really love. So, you know, check it out, use it as a resource. Maybe it'll make, you know, some of the aspiring artists out there jump into something that makes them feel happy with their day-to-day life.
Excellent. Well, in that case, guys, we're going to shut off the podcast. We want to thank all you guys who tuned in today for joining us for another awesome podcast. You know, we also thank Ghost Town Media for being very informative and, you know, giving really good answers. So with that in mind, I'd like to thank you guys for joining us, and we can't wait to see you guys on the next podcast.
Cool. Thanks, guys.
Bye, everybody.
Bye. Bye.